This is The Stateless Man for the pursuit of individual liberty beyond arbitrary borders, oppressive governments, and myths of national obligations. If you value liberty and are willing to migrate and vote with your feet, you've come to the right place.
Welcome back to another episode of The Stateless Man. This is your host, Fergus Hodgson, broadcasting live from Raleigh, North Carolina, and we are pursuing liberty beyond borders. That is international living, financial independence, and personal sovereignty. And I want to mention the sponsor of the show, that is AMTG Solutions, amtgs.com. They do digital media and web development. So if you're looking for a redesign of your website or to start a new website, be sure to check them out, amtgs.com. Now, I'm also joined this afternoon by Rachel Mills of rachelmills.com and the Full Frontal Liberty podcast. She's a wonderful addition to the team. And I want to get straight to the content because we have such limited time. I'll just mention briefly that later on in the show, we're going to be having a discussion of Michael Colgan's article regarding how to overcome your fears. In the second hour, we're going to have Yael Ossovsky calling in from Austria and updates on the European Union, on the European Students for Liberty Conference. And then finally, we'll have a discussion with Lewis Andrews of the Yankee Institute regarding how impediments to freedom of movement or free movement lead to human trafficking or feed that industry. Now, the first question I have for Ron Paul, who needs no introduction, basically, he is one of the biggest promoters of liberty on the planet and an inspiration for many people. So I want to introduce this one with the question of competitive currencies. Why is this such a big issue for you? Why have you made it a prominent issue when I know that many people think it's out there, it's not in the mainstream, and they'll mock you about it?
Most people know I don't like the central bank. The central bank we have, the Federal Reserve, has been here for 100 years, and they systematically undermine the value of our currency. It's down about 98% since 1913. So the question is, how do you go from where we are to a better system? And most of the time, whether it's in education or medicine or even in money, the best transition can be just allow competition. Don't have a law that says you can't do it. And now there are laws against using gold and silver, and they'll close you down because they call you counterfeiters. At the same time, it's the politicians and the Federal Reserve that are the counterfeiters. So if you would just legalize freedom, it would work out, and the transition would be a lot softer. But right now, we're going to go through the ringer, and it'll probably include the whole world, as the dollar loses its value, and it'll eventually be a panic, and you will see rapidly rising prices and possibly even runaway inflation. But if you would just legalize it and let people decide, maybe somebody would use gold, some people use silver, some people might use a basket of currency, there will only be one rule you have to follow, and that is no fraud. You can't lie to the people. You can't deceive. If you have a contract and you're using a contract to settle a business arrangement, or you want to use certificates, they have to be honored. They have to be, you know, you can't defraud people. Our governments have done this notoriously. So I think the free market could come up with a much better system than we've ever had. It is not going to be perfect, but it's going to be 100,000, you know, thousands of times better than anything government has ever concocted.
I want to note, too, that you mentioned that right now alternative currencies are often prosecuted, including the Liberty dollar, which unfortunately went down, including a whole lot of coins with your image on them. But have you looked into a new digital medium of exchange, Bitcoin? Have you been investigating that at all?
To a degree, but I have to admit that I don't have a complete understanding of that. If it's true competition and they don't commit fraud, I'm all for it. And evidently, they seem to be very free market oriented. And I don't know of anything negative, but I'm not expert enough to know exactly what's going on. For some reason, I guess my reluctance to a degree is I think of money as something that, if you have a certificate or if you have a digit or something, how do you convert it into something that you can hold in your hand and put in your pocket or put in your safe, for the ultimate test of survival? But it may be something like Bitcoin that would come up If we would actually make sure that it's perfectly legal for us to compete with the Federal Reserve System.
Right. Now, I want to get your thoughts, too, on basically many years now in the political life. And I had my own question. One of the listeners contributed a question. This is Jose from the Bronx in New York. He said, here's my question I have for the man that woke me up. How do you take all of this in as a human being, and why have you dedicated most of your life to fight for people who don't even have a clue about who you are? Thanks for planting the seed of liberty in me. My path was strayed, and you helped me find myself.
Well, in many ways, it's self-serving. First thing is I enjoy doing it because I think the ideas are fascinating. I think they're very, very important. The freer this country is, the happier I'll be, the safer I'll be, and the more likely it is that I will be able to own property and pass it on to the children and grandchildren. So I think we all have to do everything politically in our own interest. If you do it like you're giving up something that you're sacrificing, I never feel like I'm sacrificing time. I think some of the rewards or the enjoyment is at meeting the people. So if there's no enjoyment in doing this and you want to only see how many gold coins you can accumulate, then you have to worry about running around the world and find out where you hide them and what you're going to do and how you're going to travel. And there's nothing wrong with that either. Anybody who takes care of themselves is providing a great service, not only for themselves, but for everybody else. So I think that, you know, even on the other end of the spectrum, why do people tolerate, dictators? There is a saying, and in general it's true, that governments don't exist if they're not satisfied, if the people don't support it. You know, finally, the people in the Soviet Union couldn't support it, and the system fell apart. So it's something that, important that we do understand it and support it, and we do it in our own interest. Up until now, everybody in this country thought both the corporate welfareists and the other welfareists on the food stamps and free housings and free education, they believed government was going to take care of them and everybody was going to benefit. But they've endorsed Keynesian economics and fiat money and deficit financing. They did it in their own self-interest. But right now, major changes are occurring, and we see that around the world today. So the next step is, what are they going to do in their own best interest? And I say, if they look to a free society, it serves the interests of everybody the best way possible.
Yeah, and along those lines, hi, Paul, this is Rachel. Remember me?
I think I do. I remember you, Rachel. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm here with Fergus in studio, so I can him under the table if he goes out of line at all.
Sure.
But yeah, Jeffrey Tucker actually had a quote similar to that about liberty, and the best way to serve liberty is to do what you're good at, and a life well lived is the best way to serve liberty. So I like that.
Well, have you, Dr. Paul, are you familiar with Harry? I mean, I imagine you know of Harry Brown. Have you read his book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World? Because he particularly makes that point you make, that it has to really, it should be in your self-interest, that he doesn't really promote a sacrificial entry into the political realm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I talk to crowds, I bring this up. I tell them, I said, you know, everybody said, to solve these problems, we all have to sacrifice. I said, well, I don't use those words. I if I give you more freedom, less regulation, decisions and responsibilities on your own, keep your own money and not have an income tax, what are you sacrificing? Wouldn't this be a tremendous gift to a person if we could just leave people alone? So, no, I don't think it is the sacrifice. It means that it's hard work and effort, but I think sacrifice is not exactly the best word to describe what we're trying to do.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the language of communism anyway, so
sure,
I agree.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Sacrifice to the state.
We have another question here, which is more of a practical one. This is David from Gadsden, Alabama. Many of the people tuning into this network, we may have to actually take this one after the break as well, but many people tuning into this network already see the writing on the wall in the United States and are looking at other countries for liberty and freedom. Do you have an opinion regarding where the next America, quote, might be, and how much longer do we have before the borders are closed off and we are unable to leave the United States?
Well, you know, that's a hard one to answer. I think that's always a threat. And I said something pretty seriously that I got a bit of ridicule for in the debate, you know, when they talked about the fences at our borders to keep out, you know, the illegals. I said, well, sometimes I think they might be putting that fence up to keep us in. And financially speaking, that generally is what happens, is they don't allow you to take your money or yourself out of the country. And even though we don't have inclusive capital controls right now, that's always a threat. But there's a lot of conditions. I mean, if you want to expatriate, you know, the IRS is going to be watching you very carefully. Now, I don't think there's any one place that I don't know where I would go. That's why I do the fighting right here.
Because hold on, we have to go to a break. So stay with us, folks. We are speaking with Dr. Ron Paul, libertarian extraordinaire, and we will be right back after the break. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
From China's Great Wall to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, this is the Overseas Radio Network.
This is The Stateless Man alongside Rachel Mills.
Hello.
And we are broadcasting live from Raleigh, North Carolina. We have a special guest, Ron Paul, on today, and I've received a flood of questions for him over the last few days. So I want to continue with those. So this one comes from Chuck Suter from constitutionalwar.org. Dr. Paul, what are your thoughts on tomorrow being March 19, 2013, the 10th year or 10-year anniversary of the Iraq War? Do you believe the conservative base, you could say the Tea Party groups or conservative people in the United States, are finally starting to admit that you were right?
Well, yes, there's a lot more. If I go to a college campus, I've never had too much grief from young people about my stance on the war. But I think more and more people have come around to this, even and probably even in a more important area, is those who did support the war, and the average Republican now. It is not so negative as it was before. I think they're beginning to see that there's been no victors. I saw a headline the other day I thought described it pretty well. The United States won the military war. The Iranians won the peace. And the Turks won the contracts. And I'd like to add, the American people lost, you know, regardless. But, no, it was a senseless venture. We're not finished with it. We're still over there. We still have the largest embassy in the world. Probably $2 to $3 trillion has been spent. We have hundreds of thousands of people seeking help, veterans, that will go on for years and years. Nobody knows exactly how much this will cost. And this was all done to kill one man, it looks like. The only thing they can say, well, this is what we achieved. We killed Saddam Hussein. Well, you know, it wasn't too many years before that that he was an ally of ours, you know, and we worked with him and encouraged him to invade Iran.
Okay, this one comes from Shane of Anna, Illinois, in the United States. And how do you justify using the Republican Party when they arguably have attacked social liberty issues more than any other party? That might be the war on drugs, openness to immigration, and invasions of privacy.
Well, I would argue the case that even with all the sins of the Republican parties, Republican Party, the Democrat Party, shows no signs that they're any better. It's only rhetoric. You know, if you say, well, I can go along with the Republicans because they're a little bit better on economic policies and balanced budget, which they're not. And then if you say, well, the Democrats aren't so bad on civil liberties and drug wars, well, no, they talk better, but how good was Obama on arresting people for smoking marijuana? And he's now won the world, Nobel Prize for Peace, and he immediately expanded the war in Afghanistan. He's looking for trouble all around the world. So I would say that both parties have big problems. Both parties basically agree on all the big issues. They agree on the issue of welfare, corporatism, war, Federal Reserve, and they said, well, isn't there a big difference on budget? No, not really. It's just a whole lot of talk. Besides, the budget is almost irrelevant compared to what a Federal Reserve can do. I mean, they'll argue over $10 billion here and there, the Federal Reserve can create $10 trillion at will and have no control and no audit.
We've got a question here. Rachel wanted to say what's going on in Cyprus right now.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you if you've been following what's been going on in Cyprus about the European Central Bank basically threatening to confiscate a portion of depositors' money in the bank. And
I think 9% for anyone with more than 100,000 euros or something like that.
A
substantial
proportion. 9%. They're just going to take it and call it a tax, but they're basically stealing money out of the bank from the people that have deposits there. And what do you think are the chances of that eventually happening in the United States if the Europeans have shown that they're willing to consider that option?
Well, they will probably do it a little more wisely in the sense that they won't tip the people off and then have them all run and get their money out. They sensed that this was coming. And, of course, the outrage caused them to change their mind about taking funds out of the lower amounts, you know, less than 100,000. But, no, countries do this all the time. Our IRS does it rather routinely. But to do it on every bank account shows you how panicked they are. I think this, once again, represents the whole problem throughout the world, even in this country, is we're bankrupt. And we can't pay the debt, and everybody knows we can't pay the debt. It's how do you liquidate debt? Now, Cyprus is trying to get a bailout, and if they get a bailout from the European Central Bank and from Germany, essentially, this means that they're going to opt for devaluation, print more money, print more euros, bail people out, and we'll take control. The only other way you can liquidate debt is go bankrupt, declare bankruptcy and wipe the debt off the books, which is a more honest way of doing it. But generally, countries can't do it. They're going to try desperately to do this, and they'll do it, and that's what we do here. I mean, what would happen if the Fed wasn't buying $85 billion a month? Interest rates would skyrocket and the market would crash. So the markets are dependent on feeding this. But eventually the debt will be liquidated because there will be, you know, the devaluation of the currency and prices will go up. But this is done because people won't face up to the fact that we have a bankruptcy and they won't give up on government largesse. Rich and poor become so dependent, whether it's the military-industrial complex or the 48 million people getting food stamps. There's no way they're going to change these habits until you have a calamity. And I think when you see these shakeouts like we're seeing in Cyprus, we're getting closer and closer. Someday it'll happen to the big currencies and quite possibly to the United States dollar.
Oh, no, yeah, I'd like to go to another question. This one comes from Mark in England, and he says, Dr. Paul, you suggested that respecting property rights could constitute a plan against the threat of global warming, and but this person is concerned that carbon dioxide is not easily measured and that it may be an exception to that rule of thumb or approach. Do you still acknowledge that property rights are a good source of action to deal with pollution that is perhaps of a non-traditional kind?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at the greatest polluter, the one that used most of the hydrocarbons is the Pentagon, more than probably all the other many countries around the world. So I would say I was raised in the city of Pittsburgh, and it was the most polluted city in the country for a long time. And the steel mills put out the soot, and the cities put in the sewers into the rivers. And it was cleaned up a long time before the EPA came in. It was cleaned up on a basic local control of property rights. You don't have the right to damage your neighbor's property. So they had city ordinances about what you could do and couldn't do. So I would say that the basic libertarian principle that you can't hurt your neighbor's property, you can't dump your garbage on a neighbor's property. So if it's some type of air contamination, water contamination, or whatever, it should be stopped. But the corporations and big governments are the ones who, you know, colluded for many, many years, especially in the early years of the Industrial Revolution. So, yes, it is true that the market approach to property rights would not be perfect. But what do you do today? You have these plans of saying, well, we'll tax them, and then we'll have options to pollute, and then you trade them, and then get into the market and say, okay, if you pay this, you can pollute so much. Well, in a free market, you wouldn't be talking in that manner. If you're polluting, it's wrong, and they have to be stopped by the courts.
Yeah, we just want one more question. This one is from a person through Reddit. Do you oppose intellectual property such as patents and copyrights?
Do I oppose property rights?
Intellectual and copyrights. Intellectual property such as patents and copyrights.
Well, you know, I think that needs a lot of explaining to do, because you do have copyright rights. You know, if you write a book, if I write a book, you can't take the book, and I have rights to that. You can't use it. So, to some degree, but it can get pretty sickly, and a lot of libertarians disagree on how to handle that. But I do believe in property rights. If I write something, you can't plagiarize, and there's rules against that. But I would agree that there's a lot of murky areas in there that I don't think I...
Cut off. We're nearing the break, so I just want to say thank you, and thank you for Rachel for arranging this interview.
Thank you, Dr. Paul.
Okay, good to talk to you. Bye.
Bye now. So, folks, yeah, that was Ron Paul. A pleasure to speak with him. Stay with us. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, your online radio resource about life abroad.
This is The Stateless Man with Rachel Mills of RachelMills.com and the Full Frontal Liberty Podcast.
Hello.
Right, and we are seeking to get hold of Michael Colgan, the planned guest for this half hour, but... even if we can't get him on, we do have his article, which I posted. This originally appeared on the Facebook page of the Colgan Institute, and I contacted them to repost it on our site. So it just gives some thoughts. I mean, I'll just give some background that Michael Colgan was someone that I really looked up to. I read lots of his books growing up, Optimum Sports Nutrition, The New Power Program, and a few others about, I think, how to use creatine, monohydrate, and other supplements. Anyway, so in I think 2005, I'm not sure, one of the years back in the 2000s, I flew up to Vancouver and went out to Salt Spring Island where he lives and his institute is located. They were holding I think it was a week-long power program or strength training conference, and I attended that. So I got to meet him and learn from him, and I wanted to bring him on today. We've just had intermittent contact. I did confirm, he did write back a confirmation, but I haven't been able to reconfirm in the last week or so. Regardless, the latest article that drew my attention is titled, What Are We Afraid Of? And you can see that on thestatelessman.com. And basically, the key premise of the article is that fear is simply an emotional construction, that it doesn't really exist. It's not a physical thing. But the manifestations of fear are very real. That is to say that your own stress or fear has a detrimental impact on your health. And he says, quote, large fear reactions are different in quality, not just amount, and can cause serious illness. Fear that is not dissipated by vigorous physical activity builds up excitatory chemicals in the brain to damaging levels, and they can puncture cell membranes, cause chemical leaks, and form a deadly free radical called peroxynitrite. Anyway, so
do you think he would categorize stress as the same chemical thing?
I don't think so. And I'm thinking here he's talking about you could say a surge of fear or something that I'm not.
Like
this
adrenaline.
Is basically an adrenaline, yes. And he seemed to he wanted to say that this you can control this. That basically these negative outcomes are still in your control. And he has a few thoughts as to how to resolve them. So. He also noted that, just as some examples, that there have been records throughout history of witch doctors simply pointing a harmless bone that literally frightens a victim to death. And cool water has been known to raise real burns if the victim is led to actually fear that the water is boiling. So, yeah, I mean, I got the frightened the victims to death. I found sources for that. I couldn't confirm the real burns one. So I was looking for a documentation to that.
Well,
one,
dry ice can burn you.
Dry ice can burn you. That's even colder than water. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, he said his proposals were, whenever you're becoming afraid, just say, there I go, frightening myself again. Or basically just be conscious, aware of this fact and dismiss it, or basically take control of it. And then, as we learned back in psychology courses in college, he says, face diluted situations of your worst fears. So,
what does that mean?
That means that if you're afraid of snakes, you know, get a little lizard and become Become accustomed to the presence of something that's not as severe as your real fear.
And then work up to, like, snake handling?
Yes.
Sounds good.
So he said the example that he gave is that a brilliant student was so afraid of public speaking, he would be struck dumb and trembling and have to leave the stage.
It's a common fear.
So he said he just invited him to sit in the hall with him, an empty lecture hall, to speak and gradually bring in more people until he became comfortable doing lectures in front of international audiences. And so that is logical, plausible.
Sure.
I guess it depends what fear you have.
Bears. I'm afraid of bears.
Are you serious?
I think that's a
good
fear.
Don't go to the Rockies.
I don't think I want to overcome that fear. I just want to avoid it.
Yeah, just avoiding it seems like the way to go. In New Zealand, we don't have any dangerous animals, so it's
no
bizarre.
Dangerous animals in New Zealand?
No snakes.
Really?
And no bears, nothing.
No exotic spiders?
Some have been coming in from Australia.
Ah.
Yeah. So I think we've got redbacks now, so probably our first poisonous animal. But yeah, so he said the final point he wanted to make is that fear has many instinctive bodily expressions, and these you can control. So covering the people will crouch or cover their eyes or tremble or whatever. He says basically if you feel fear consciously, mm-hmm. work against such bodily expressions.
And then maybe your body will follow.
It's so weird how basically, yeah, this is almost a circle of communication with yourself, where if you feel fear and demonstrate in your body, it just reinforces it. So he says,
act less afraid and then you'll be less afraid.
Stand erect, square your shoulders, relax your muscles and breathe deeply, you know, smile, face your fear and march directly and purposefully.
I will try that next time I run into a bear.
Sorry. You know, there was a great comedian, a Canadian comedian I saw years ago, who was saying how these roles about bears are so ridiculous that you're supposed to play dead. He said, who plays dead with a bear anyway? So, so yeah, basically, if people want to check out this article, which has, like I said, some thoughts on the physical manifestations of fear and just a few thoughts on what you can do about it, it is available on thestatelessman.com. And that also links through to the Colgan Institute and Michael Colgan's Facebook page.
Yeah, and in all seriousness, I'm not talking about bears, but, you know, other fears of common everyday situations can be very limiting.
Well, this network is the Overseas Radio Network,
yeah.
And people here are afraid of expatriating, going to a place they don't know.
It is a scary thing.
There is a bias in many instances, including the political realm, you could say a status quo bias. That we just stay with what we know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why in politics, incumbents keep getting
I know, it's terrible.
Because
yeah.
People are less afraid of the monster that they know than the monster that they don't know.
But it's not a monster. That's to say that what they don't know may be much better.
Right.
So so I'm not sure what impedes people from expatriating because I've done it too many times now. But
you know the monster. And you know that it's not a monster.
Yeah, it's not. And I'm not sure what I can say about overcoming that. I never really understood the fear to begin with in that regard. I was excited about the idea of expatriating.
Yeah, but you were how young?
Well, I first left to live in the United States when I was 19.
See, 19-year-olds know no fear.
Sure. And then I went to live in Canada when I think I was 24, 25.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just say that I think that life is so short, so I wouldn't want those fears, which in my view, aren't necessarily based on rational thought, just on, yeah, exactly, a sort of like an emotion to get in the way of things.
My guess is you were probably more afraid of being unsatisfied staying where you were.
A boring life.
Yeah.
Sure.
That was a bigger fear.
Yeah, I'm afraid of that. Sorry. I don't know if that's a healthy fear or not.
There's a lot of people that would tell you that the realization of that fear is something to be avoided. So
right.
Good on ya.
Okay, well... Yeah, so people, I'll just say, yeah, the website is thestatelessman.com. And if you want to stay up to date regarding the work of the website, you can follow on Twitter at thestatelessman. We've got an email newsletter, or probably the most active area for statelessman updates is the Facebook page. It's just facebook.com/thestatelessman, or just look up statelessman in Facebook and you will find the page, no problem. And I'm going to post this article up there right now below today's airing segment. And I've got a whole list of topics we can discuss afterwards. I'll say that there's been so much news in the expatriation realm. Rachel just mentioned this, the reality that's going on in Cyprus right now, but there are a lot of other developments, and I'm eager to get through to those.
Absolutely.
Yes. So, yeah, if you want to call in to have a question or comment, particularly about the Ron Paul interview, you're welcome to. It's 1-888-741-7472. So stay with us, folks. This is the Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
This is the Stateless Man, pursuing liberty beyond borders. It's my pleasure to be back and to be joined by the lovely Rachel Mills of rachelmills.com.
Hello.
Right. So, and we were discussing, yeah, this coming to grips with fears, or taking, you might say, a rational or even-handed approach to this instinct that we have. And Rachel was saying that she is afraid of bears, and it's pretty hard to argue with that one.
I think it's a good fear. I think it's healthy. However,
have you seen a bear in the wild?
It was contained.
Oh, really? In a cage?
Yes. So that, I guess that means it's not the wild.
Because I was in Canada, up in Quebec once, and I saw a bear at this farm, and I was going, this guy looks like a little teddy bear. He looks so friendly.
Yeah, don't hug him. We really do our children a disservice by, you know, giving them teddy bears.
I know.
Make them think that if they run into a bear, they could just run up and hug it. That's
right. Wild that's animals.
Child endangerment. They
play for keeps. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we have Brad the Butcher Jordan, who is a host also on the Overseas Radio Network. His show is Food Riot Radio, and that airs at 10 a.m. on Mondays.
Brad the Butcher.
That's right.
I'm slicing up food news, serving up fresh, raw, and real.
Did Sarah Burrows host that with you, co-host that?
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. She did a great job today. She actually had better questions than me for Miss Sally Fallon Morrill.
Right. Have you dropped the Sarah Foxy Burrows element of the name?
She's just too damn hot to drop it. Why would I do that?
Yeah. So, but what the point, Brad, we were actually speaking during the break with Brad Jordan, because he called and he wanted to dispute the notion that fear was something to be concerned about, and that it's really just a natural and healthy instinct. And I said, my concern is that we have, you could say, yes, a healthy instinct when a bear is near you, you got to do something. Or when someone is coming, driving head on towards you, you need this kind of adrenaline. But there are also times when perhaps, let's say you're a young man and you see a beautiful girl across the room. You want to go and talk to her, but you are afraid.
Don't be afraid.
She might say no. She might look at you like you're a loser.
That could happen, but don't be afraid.
Yeah, so so I was just saying to Brad that there's a difference between an instinct that has legitimate ground to it and one that does not.
See, and that's where fear is very limiting, and it's a bad thing.
Yeah, and I use the example of expatriation as one to consider. And one little tidbit that I mentioned with Brad was that many people I know think that if they move to Latin America, for example, that'll just be far more dangerous. But in fact, most of the major cities in the United States basically have a similar rate of crime as many of these Latin American cities. And the most dangerous Latin American country is Honduras. And that actually has about the same, I think even slightly lower murder rate than New Orleans. And I'm not saying New Orleans is a haven for low crime,
but most Americans would not be afraid to go to New Orleans.
Exactly.
But they would be afraid to go to Honduras.
Right.
But can I add this?
Yes.
Is that fear like that in skewing the news stories that you report and maybe emphasizing more crime in other places, that's a very useful tactic for governments to use in order to keep people in their place.
Well, it's not only governments. I mean, just news outlets do it by default. I think you mentioned, yeah, coming to the United States. And one of my first memories of arrival here was when I was I was going to visit Boston University. I was in the youth hostel in Boston. We're just sitting around eating, and the TV was on, and the news came on. And it was just so scary or in your face or sensationalist. I could hardly believe it. People, they were playing on fears. And this one wasn't about fear. It was just, how can I describe this? Let me give you my demo. Okay, I'm gonna resist more American accents, but this one is one that I remember. It's like, after the break. A sex act on a school bus.
Boy, there you go. That's another tactic, I think, is keeping people afraid of each other makes them want government services and government protection more.
It just means that you are less confident to stand on your own two feet.
Right.
But we do have Brad. I mean, are you still with us, Brad? Maybe not. We've lost it. We've lost our man.
Maybe you gave him bad advice on the microphone.
Right. I guess the microphone wasn't so clear, but let's go to some of these news stories that I had saved up, because the deal is that, like I said, there's a lot of news going on in the realm of the expatriation or Liberty Beyond Borders field. And I just want to keep people mindful of those, because basically there are new developments. And if you want to stay in touch with these or follow them, best way is to like the Facebook page and follow the Twitter, because I'll be posting these all the time. Now, let's go to 5 ways to make money as you travel. Is that an interesting topic? Well, I've basically got a million different articles I've been collecting during the week that I just thought were interesting. 10 questions before quitting a job.
Oh, how do you make money as you travel?
Yeah, so this one is from a friend of mine, actually. She, Tara Lynn Groth, I think it is, she writes, it's called writenaked.wordpress.com.
Oh.
Writing life.
Is that one way to make money?
5 ways to make money as you travel, yeah. So basically, I'm going to post this one on the Stateless Man page, but basically, traveling for work or pleasure as a writer does not have to disrupt your work flow. You can still meet deadlines and experience little interruption if you plan ahead. I go to Asheville a few times throughout the year to host writing workshops, and I travel to New York frequently. I also get stranded in New York frequently. So in October, I flew up to Long Island for a wedding, only to have my flight canceled repeatedly due to a superstorm, Sandy. So she's just saying, I guess as a writer, you have the opportunity to live a more flexible lifestyle. And she makes these suggestions. You can write about hotspots that are arising. You can interview people. What are we going
to do? So all of these are ways to write.
To basically be a writer and make money doing
it. Like a travel writer.
Yeah. Which I'm guessing many people would love to do.
If they're good writers. But
sure.
Some people are not good writers.
You can just learn. Yep.
I don't know. to some extent, maybe you can, but you have to have, I think, to write well, some inborn talent.
You think so?
I do. I don't think that you can entirely be taught how to write well.
Sure. I'm usually strongly supportive. I mean, basically, you just being able to learn, because short story, when I first came to the United States again and arrived at Boston University, they thought my writing was so bad that it was basically that I must have had a second language, or that English was not my first language. And I said, no, New Zealanders, we speak English. But
sort of.
Yeah. And so, but basically, I had terrible writing. And only by being really aggressive and learning have I been able to become a professional writer. And I've been nationally syndicated across the United States and been in lots of major outlets. So I actually think that the people who taught me at a young age did me a terrible disservice and knocked my confidence, only because I was really desperate to get good grades and graduate did I really turn that around.
Well, that's interesting. I'm the same way with math, but I don't think I can be taught. I think I'm too old for that skill. But well, that's very interesting.
And also, yeah, not only that, I just, yeah, like I said, I turned that around. And additionally, I remember one time I went to a writing conference. This one was put on by the Institute for Humane Studies, which does great work sponsoring internships, just theihs.com. And there, one of the professors or lecturers said that if you don't have lots of ideas for writing a blog, for example, or if one blog idea gets rejected from an outlet and you don't have another to replace it right away, that you probably shouldn't be a writer. I just thought that was terrible advice, because the fact is that when you get started, you don't really know how to fit into the discussion, perhaps.
There's a lot of noise out there.
There is.
As the blogosphere.
Exactly. And you've got to think of a way that, how can I add value to this realm and offer a unique perspective or something that is going to give, if people read it, they'll actually go away smarter or happier, yeah, or whatever it may be.
And I think to some extent, automatically, by being an international traveler, you do have something unique to say.
Sure.
Already.
Yeah. More than most people, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So I'll just say that if you want to become a writer, I encourage people to try it out. Maybe you won't become successful. That's where Rachel is concerned. But I would recommend, and actually we do accept submissions to thestatelessman.com. You can email those to me or just inquiries, ideally just with a headline and an idea rather than writing the whole article, to ferg@thestatelessman.com, and I'll give you some support as to whether I think it's relevant to the readers of the website. And I'll post this article from Tara. She leads the meetup, the Triangle Writers meetup here that I go to, and it's a great community of people who are professional writers, and they network and tell you how you can make a living doing it. So it's possible. They're doing it. The lady who leads it is doing it, and I think it's a wonderful outlet, particularly if you want to be a more internationally oriented person. She has done this within the United States, but I know a professional travel writer who I met in New Orleans, and he does it on an ongoing basis. He's been doing it for years. So I think, too, there's kind of like a snowballing effect. As you become more independent, additional people follow you, and it sort of builds a readership at the same time. You could have created this industry of travelers who are networking and sharing ideas about how to make a living on the road. So we are nearing the end of the break, and I'm sorry we dropped Brad Jordan of Food Right Radio, but I'm going to just mention his website, which is foodrightradio.com. That one runs 10 to 11 Monday mornings, just before this one. But otherwise, stay with us. After the break, we're going to have Yael Osofsky and broadcasting The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
From China's Great Wall to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, this is the Overseas Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Stateless Man. This is Fergus Hodgson broadcasting live from Raleigh, North Carolina. The show is sponsored by AMTG Solutions. That's AMTGS.com for all your digital media and web development services. They do great new websites and website redevelopment. So, and I'm pleased to have Rachel Mills alongside me.
Hello.
Right. So, and Rachel was the one who can take credit for arranging the Ron Paul interview this episode, which was a real pleasure.
It was my pleasure.
Right. Yeah. So, and Rachel's own website is rachelmills.com. She does the Full Frontal Liberty podcast, which is kind of like a work in progress, but
it is an evolving project. But I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Right. And I've recommended her episode number 4, which was about her interview with Obama, which is.
Yep, I had to pull in a lot of favors from my time in Washington, D.C.
It is a work of art in terms of editing, I will say, as well. But
not related, I had just recently discovered sound effects and how to edit those into my podcast. That sure. Is in no way related to my interview with Obama.
Yeah, we're going to have to play a clip of that on the show sometime. But one of the sort of best friends of this show and website, he is on the line with us right now. His name is Yael Osofsky. He lives in Vienna, Austria, and he's originally from Quebec, but he's another fellow stateless man, you could say. He spent a lot of his life here in North Carolina, and he's been an investigative reporter, podcaster. His own podcast is Liberty in Exile, libertyinexile.com, and he's written a couple of articles for The Stateless Man recently. The most, you could say, like freshest in terms of newsiness is about the European Students for Liberty Conference, which was not this weekend that we just had, but the one before. And he wrote, I'm going to post this one as well. The title is European Students for Liberty Promise New Generation of Freedom. And this is why I get excited about Students for Liberty, because if you go to their events, it just gives you a wonderful optimism that there is this new generation of people who are informed, they understand economics, they understand they can take care of themselves, they're proud. And I'm just so impressed by this. So Yael is one such man, and he's doing great work. I mean, he's taking the initiative, and he's moved to Europe to basically be involved in what's going on in Europe and to better understand it. He's doing a master's degree, I think, right now. So I could continue on speaking good things about him. But yeah, so Yael, welcome back to the show.
Fergus, thank you very much for the praise. And Rachel, thank you for also having me on there as co-host.
Good to have you.
Right. So Yael, have you been to a European Students for Liberty event before, prior to this one?
No, this was actually my first one ever in the history of the world.
Sorry, first Students for Liberty or just European Students for Liberty?
No, European Students for Liberty. I've been to similar Students for Liberty conferences in Philadelphia and I believe one down in Florida. There was one in Gainesville. But I got to say, it really is an incredible mashing of people from all over the place. So it was really great to be there.
Right, and yet 350 people, really an impressive amount. I'm amazed because, as I said before, Students for Liberty, as far as I know, they only began in 2008. So what, are they in their sixth year or something like that? And so that's basically, when I was a student and an undergraduate, they didn't even exist. And this year in the United States, they had like 1,400 or 1,300 people, and then 350 in Europe. And was that more than people expected, or how did people respond to the turnout? How did the leaders respond to that?
Well, I guess I believe they expected just from the initial registration maybe over 200, and then it started creeping up in the last few days. But really, at registration, a lot more people showed up. And again, there's a great map that you'll find on the Students for Liberty website and probably on the European Students for Liberty Facebook page. I mean, we're talking countries from all over Europe, people from North America, people from Turkey, Russia, I mean, all these different Baltic states. I mean, places you would never even think that liberty lives on. People are interested in these ideas.
Yeah, I'm amazed too. Just traveling so far, I'm just impressed at the commitment people have. Now, and there's one photo you have of the attendees, and it looks like this room is just overflowing with people. So that's just great. Now, how did it live up to or match your expectations? I mean, you've been to these conferences before. How would you say it was distinct from others?
Well, with this one, I guess compared to the American Students for Liberty, there was a lot more diversity in that you had different languages being spoken everywhere. And yes, of course, there were groups speaking French, some speaking German, and I was doing my best to speak to all of them that I could. But in the end, everyone was speaking the same language. It was the same ideas being presented. It was those of whether it be classical liberalism, libertarianism, like just a renewed sense that people can take control of their future and it can be invested in the future of tomorrow. And that's really what these people were all about.
Well, one of the maybe ironic points you make is that you describe Europe as the continent which gave birth to liberty. And many people these days would say it's the exact opposite, that it's the home of the police and welfare state. How do you reconcile that, perhaps not necessarily contradiction, but you might say a confusion?
Well, I mean, the birth of the police and welfare state, again, so we've only had these probably for around 200 years, but when you go back to the antique ideas of liberty, we're talking the Roman Empire, we're talking the Magna Carta, we're talking these are really the basic principles that have enshrined, I guess, the founding documents of a lot of the newer countries, such as the United States, and principles that we once thought our governments would uphold forever. But again, it seems as if here on the European continent, we do need a renewal of such, and I think that's why all these people came together and they were very excited about doing that.
Right.
Yeah, they must be fed up.
No, I mean, the greatest part, I think, was hearing every individual story, because there's not one single story as in the United States. It's so many different ones with different leaders, different languages. Everybody's pretty much facing the same problem of a more collectivist, more statist society, and they're really trying to find a way out of that. And I think these are the types of people that at least people in their own countries are going to want to turn to when everything hits the fan, as it were.
What are the thoughts there about the European Union? Is that like a main topic of discussion over there?
Well, of course, I think I'm probably one of the biggest Euroskeptics, hence why me being at this conference itself was very interesting. But most of the people here realize that it was basically an anti-democratic experiment. And you had people from Spain who were talking how terrible it was, people from Greece. And I guess now the people in Cyprus were having their money stolen from the Eurocrats know what it's all about. But I would say on the whole that most people realized that the European project is not one that engenders liberty and is very hostile to the freedoms that are so dear to them.
Sure, it's more centralized power rather than less, so
yeah.
it's always bad.
Yeah, we are approaching the next break, but I'll just say that we're speaking with Yale Osofsky, and his latest article was European Students for Liberty Promise New Generation of Freedom. That is on thestatelessman.com. I'm going to post a link to that to the Stateless Facebook page. If you want a question to ask him, Yale, particularly about how an expat from the United States moves to a place like Austria and why one would do that, you can call in 1-888-741-7472. Otherwise, stay with us. This is the Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
This is the Stateless Man pursuing liberty beyond borders, and it's my pleasure to have Yale Sosky reporting from over in Austria. Now, we're discussing how he was saying how the ideas of liberty do seem to flow from European history, even if the welfare and warfare states have arisen since that time. And then we also mentioned the presence of the European Union and what that means. Do you mind sharing a personal note as to why you would choose voluntarily to go to live in Europe?
I think for a lot of people it's sort of been a huge inquisitive concern, especially when they hear my accent when I speak to a lot of these people at the conference. I guess framing it correctly, I am someone who is very skeptical of centralized power.
You have such a thick American accent, Yale.
I know. It's terrible.
How is Germany, Dad?
Yeah, I guess when you speak German, yeah. Okay.
No, actually, when I speak German, I'm told I sound like a French man, my first language.
That's awesome.
Right.
Yeah, okay. I guess that I have to say that it has to do with what I wanted to do as a journalist. And I was doing a good job in Florida, and I liked doing it, but I wanted to think bigger. And I wanted to attack something that was probably not getting as much attention. And I really don't think there's enough scrutiny around the European Union, and I want to do my job. I want to be over here. I want to be able to write the first stories of history, the first pages of history about how the European Union really is choking freedom and choking liberty. Obviously, it helps that I was able to find an educational program to help plant me here, and a beautiful girlfriend who also invited me along the way. So that's always been very helpful, but that really is the end goal for me.
Actually, Yale does have a beautiful story in that regard. I'm working. I would like someone to write an article for the Stateless Man about how to make a long-distance relationship work, because I know so many people who are inquiring about that, and the success rate seems to be slim, but Yale has pulled it off. So,
well, if it's long-distance, it can't be long-term. You have to eventually have plans.
Sure. And I guess he's made – she moved – yeah, I don't want to give too much of his personal life, but we'll just say he's been successful in that regard. Okay, so I actually will know too that I'm not an expert in the European Union, and that's why I'm glad to have someone like Yale associated with the program, and it's really to have him writing for the site is a privilege. Now, but I often hear stories coming out of the European Union, such as that I remember the Ryanair chief executive was invited to come and speak, I guess, to make his case for deregulation of the airlines or something like that to the European Union, and they would fund his tickets to get there. And they said they don't accept discount airlines, that you can't fly to their events on discount airlines. And I just thought that's just so ironic and perhaps indicative of the culture that apparently competition is bad. And
wow.
Do you have a comment on that, Yale?
Yeah, well, of course. The European Union in itself, you have to think that it is one centralized supranational institution, but it's housed in two different places. You have the parliament in Strasbourg, France, and then you have a part-time parliament in Brussels. And you have hundreds of people who dedicate their lives daily to writing new laws and regulations without any sort of popular scrutiny. And I will say that there is some sort of this governance ideology that befalls them and makes them think that they really have to, I don't know, push their agenda of greater centralization, better control, and we know what's best for you. And I think it's the same way in that a lot of people complain about discount airlines because, well, the service isn't as good. But again, like all big bureaucratic institutions, they're not thinking about how it actually does help the people who don't have as many euros in their pockets.
You don't have to buy from that airline. I mean, that's just the basic response. Why do you care that other people are happy to have a discount airline? So
now, for that, I guess this is just another way of the European Union. Again, whenever they're in town, the hotel bills go through the roof. There's a good story that came out about 2 years ago. Yeah. The European Commission, of course, when they get together and they're writing laws and regulations, they apparently had a huge hotel party and they spent 200,000 euros in one single weekend at a hotel.
Okay.
It's
right.
Good to be king.
Yeah, that's the – man, it pains me to think about this. But, but like you say, I mean, well, we could make the same parallels with what goes on here in the United States and in Canada with the crazy pension schemes that the politicians get. There seems to be – you know, extortion going on all over the place. So you've got to kind of pick your poison to some degree, and you're seeking to make it work in the EU. And I will say, yeah, I'm very confident that you will be a successful journalist in that realm, and I'm excited to see that advance. Now, at the actual event, though, were there any sort of new insights that you learned, or was it mainly just a networking opportunity?
Well, I guess the networking helps, but I think one part,
yeah, we're losing
Stateless Man is a speaker by the name of Daniel Model. He's a Swiss fellow, industrialist, and this guy was preaching basically seceding from the state and creating your own paradise. And this is a guy who really has done a great job in doing that. I really point everyone over to the internet. Look up Daniel Model. He's also been called the anarchist of Switzerland. He's a very interesting guy, and he gave a great speech there.
Cool.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
You.
Sure.
Hey.
So I've been reading a lot about Cyprus and what's happening with their banking system and the bailouts and the confiscation of depositors' money. Is that in your experience recently there on the ground, is that causing runs on banks at all?
Yeah, how are people
responding
to that?
Yeah.
Well, actually, right now there is a huge run on the ATMs, and the central bank did close all the ATMs. There is a banking holiday that is now in effect, just like during the Great Depression in 1933 in the United States. And for the next 2 or 3 days, all banks physically will be closed. All digital access to bank accounts has been completely ceased, so you cannot access your bank account online. You cannot transfer money out of the country through PayPal, Bitcoin, any other way. So people are basically stuck to going to the ATMs if they're open, of
now,
which there
aren't
many.
Are you talking about Cyprus, or are you talking about the continent?
No, I'm talking about Cyprus on its own. But again, there are a lot of retirees in Cyprus from England, from France, and from all over. So this is hitting a lot of people.
What an irony. It's your money, except when it's not, basically.
Well, I mean, possession is 9/10 of the law. Isn't that the truth?
Basically, yeah. And this is going to give more interest in, yeah, we discussed alternative currencies with Ron Paul earlier, but I'm going to be exploring digital currencies, particularly the Bitcoin or whatever alternatives we can have in the future. Like Ron Paul, I'm still getting my own head around it. But I think that just events like this just show you how fragile these fiat currencies are. And what do you make of the future of the European, or the euro, the actual currency that people are using? What is the outlook for that? I mean, I know that some countries like Poland and the United Kingdom have resisted. Is that going to change anytime in the future, or are people trying to get out of it?
Well, again, whether or not it's a good thing, you still have the Germans who are doing a great job of pumping it up right now. So, you know, is there a flight out? No. I mean, who do you have to compare it to? The U.S. dollar? That's the thing that people are talking about on the market, is you don't really have a comparison. So I only see the European the euro getting stronger, unfortunately, until some sort of other competitive currency comes along.
Icelandic leaders have been looking at the Canadian loonie. So the Canadian dollar is one of the most resilient around right now.
Yeah, but I do have to say, Fergus, that our Canadian dollar, still is pegged to the American currency, so it will never vary too much from that. So I watch that.
Gotcha.
So back to my question, I was asking how the Cyprus situation is affecting the European continent. Is that having – are there any ATM runs happening in other countries as a result of what they're threatening to do in Cyprus?
Well, I would be lying if I said I did not go to the bank myself and withdraw a few hundred euros. But I would say that, yeah, there are, a lot of different people, and not really in Austria. Austria is a very stable country where they're not really scared about that, but definitely in places like Spain and Portugal. If you just look at the markets early this morning and you kind of read the stories, I read a little bit of the Spanish press, people are going to the ATMs just in droves. They're trying to get their money into liquid currency, get it now. I mean, we don't really know what's going to happen with Spain and Portugal coming up. These countries have already been bailed out, but they might need bailouts in the future. And I can pretty much imagine that the same is going on in Greece right now as well.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, yeah, we're going to have to wrap it up there. But, folks, Yelisovsky, he's a rising journalist. I'm going to post that article below the link on the Stateless Man page. Yael, I look forward to being in touch and to reading more of your great work, okay?
Thank you, Fergus, and thank you very much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Right on. Stay with us, folks. This is The Stateless Man. After the break, open borders and human trafficking. So a lot to consider. This is The Stateless Man on Overseas Radio Network.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, your online radio resource about life abroad.
Hey, this is Corian. And this is Lyle from This Week in Costa Rica. Do you need sound business advice from people who live it every day? Are you unsure about personal security, immigration, real estate, the language barrier? Corian and I are here to take your calls, answer your questions, put your mind at ease. With expert guests in studio and on the line every week. With our network of trusted professionals and on-the-ground accounts from two expats, tune in every week from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and start living your dream now.
Welcome back to The Stateless Man, and we are in the last half hour of the program. We've got a great guest lined up. This is Lewis Andrews, and he, let me think, he's written an article for The Freeman, and yes, his article is basically about the fact that he believes and makes a compelling case that human trafficking is a function of the fact that we have limited freedom to movement, so it just invites people to pay coyotes to... So basically, it promotes that industry, and I'm hoping that he can explain it more clearly. What we can say is that basically allows for an arbitrage situation. In other words, if there is a higher wage on another side of a border, but you can't go there, well, naturally you're going to pay a coyote, or someone else is going to kidnap you to bring you across to take advantage of it. So this is a very big problem. I mean, he mentions lots of statistics here or how lots of people identify this problem, but few people, I think, other than just trying to help the people who are going through the situation, are really addressing the underlying problem. And that's where I like the fact that he is just showing what he titles as the other good reason to reform immigration, because that would deal with the underlying problem. So this is Lewis Andrews, and he is with the Yankee Institute, a think tank in Connecticut, based at Trinity College there, and I think it's Hartford, Connecticut. And it's actually a college that I looked at going to. Anyway, so his article, yeah, is with The Freeman. I'm going to bring that up and post it on the Facebook page, just The Stateless Man on Facebook. So, Lewis, thank you for taking this interview on The Stateless Man.
Nice to be here.
Right, so what brought you to writing this article? I mean, imagine this isn't exactly part of your everyday work at the Yankee Institute.
Well, it is and it isn't. The Yankee Institute is what's called a free market think tank.
Right.
And what a free market think tank does is there are a number of them around the country in the United States and around the world. And what they free market think tanks do is they talk about applying free market solutions to social problems. And a very common example of that a lot of your listeners might be familiar with would be using school vouchers to reform public education. Instead of kids having to go to the same school as everyone else in the neighborhood, they might receive a voucher or a scholarship that would enable them to go to any school of their choice. And so that's an example of using the market to improve public education. There are a number of issues that free market think tanks tend to focus on, public education and healthcare primarily, because if you look at how governments spend money around the world, about 90% of it is on two things. It's on three things, really. It's on education, it's on healthcare, and it's on retirement benefits. And I was trying to think of a topic that might be different, where free market solutions might apply that hadn't been tried before. And I was reading something about the problem of white slavery, and I started thinking to myself, well, you know, how could one approach the problem of slavery around the world from a free market perspective? And that's what got me into writing the article for the Freeman magazine.
But when you say that this hasn't been tried before, I mean, only in this last century really have borders been policed in any serious manner.
and prior to that, passports or documents that could track you didn't really exist. So you mean in the modern era, presumably?
Yes, of course. I was really looking at, there's a serious social problem around the world is slavery, particularly of women and children. And I was wondering, you know, how someone with a libertarian or a free market perspective might look at that. And I was quite surprised to discover that, in fact, some people have done a lot of research on that subject.
Yeah, well, how does that tie into, you say, modern-day slavery, though? Do you know, help us make the connection?
Well, what I discovered as I was doing my research is that what researchers have found out, and I'm really looking at research other people have done, is that the number one cause of slavery around the world, this is, you know, people being forced into involuntary labor, sexual services or slave labor in the case of children, the number one cause of it is really the unwillingness of advanced industrial countries to have more open borders. Because primarily people get involved with slavery because they come from areas of the world where it's hard to make a living and they're trying to go somewhere else. And so they become dupes for what's called, debt bondage, where someone comes along and they say, gee, would you like to go work in America? Well, sign this contract and, you know, I can get you a job as a maid or a job, doing some seemingly legitimate thing. Then they get over to America and they discover that they've been sold into a slavery ring and there's not much they can do about it because they don't know the language, they don't have any money, they don't have any friends, you know, who could help them out. And the reason people get involved primarily in slave situations is because they've been duped by people into thinking that they can get a job overseas in a more prosperous country. And there's a lot of research now to indicate that if you had more open borders, people could move to work wherever they wanted to. That would probably stop the number one cause of slavery around the world.
Right. Actually, I just posted an article yesterday on the Facebook page, and I've got a second chapter to that article that 60% of people in Honduras, for example, if they could, would leave the country. And people, even though they're desperately poor, they will borrow $5,000 basically or more to get a coyote to take them across the border in the hope that they can pay that back. They're just so desperate. So this is kind of like a well-known phenomenon. We observe people going to great lengths to get to wealthier countries and taking great risks. And we also observe human trafficking. Why are we not making the logical connection and people basically promoting a freer flow of movement?
Well, I think a lot of the problems are political. I'm just speaking now from the point of view of the United States. A lot of constituencies in the United States that would normally support greater freedom, particularly for people who are poor or minorities, are not necessarily in favor of open borders. And the number one example of this would be labor unions. In the United States, labor unions have typically supported aid for people who are poor or who have been oppressed in some way. But labor unions don't like the idea of competition when it comes to people coming across the border. So one of the problems is that you have the traditional, what you might call liberal constituencies. And what I mean by liberal is not necessarily left wing as much as just open-minded, but a lot of liberal constituencies have some problems when it comes to immigration because of the economic conflicts that it creates for their members.
Well, they're afraid about the welfare state that they've created and supported being exploited.
Well, I'm actually halfway through.
That's another factor. It's the exploitation of the welfare state, but it's also competition in the labor market.
Sure.
Well, I'm halfway through an article right now about how I see citizenship as basically just a union, and these people are not union members. So, but I don't see an easy way around that. Do you then? You don't make this point in your article, but given the destructiveness of barriers to movement, do you then support civil disobedience?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. I think, you know, Americans tend to be, I know you're an international radio program, coming at this from the American point of view. Americans tend to be pretty sympathetic to legitimate problems once they're properly exposed, which is one of the reasons that I wrote the article. I think that the problem in America is that, I mean, Americans certainly would want to stop slavery if they could, particularly, you know, the oppression of women and forced sexual services and children doing migrant labor. I don't think most Americans are simply aware of the connection between tight borders and slavery. And I think as that became, if you can make that awareness more public, I think the public as a whole would be more in favor of more open borders. And in fact, there's a movement now, you know, in
right.
the States.
Excellent. So we're going to the toy. Tight against the next break, so we have to ask you to hold that thought. Stay with us, folks. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
Your website is a major doorway to reach new clients. A dynamic web presence will generate you more leads and business. AMTG Solutions offers premium web design and digital media services for today's small businesses and entrepreneurs. Services are professional, affordable, and efficient. Visit their website at amtgs.com or email Tony at info@amtgs.com and let's get the ball rolling.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, the station to help you reach your dream destination.
This is The Stateless Man, and I'm pleased to be back with you, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, joined by Rachel Mills today. So,
hello.
We've been having just discussing the idea of open borders or freer movement between nations, and it's an issue, probably the most important issue to me in terms of the policy realm, and one that I promote on The Stateless Man. In some ways, I see it as I want to celebrate human movement because it's what so many people do to advance their lives and to bring prosperity for themselves, for their families, and I just see it as a big win-win. And as someone who has expatriated and is looking to do it again, I'll say that once you work with an immigration bureaucracy, you know that it is arbitrary and dehumanizing and not achieving any good. It's very expensive, and you become much more skeptical of these processes. So that's why I particularly promote or try and reframe our thinking to say that this is basically an act of civil disobedience, and I'm not putting the words into the mouth of our guest. He just wrote about how human trafficking promotes modern day slavery, or closed borders promotes human trafficking and modern day slavery. And then he titles it "The Other Good Reason to Reform Immigration." Now, during the break, right before the break, he was just saying how he is confident that people would change these laws if they really understood them. But my concern is that there's you might say a flaw in the flaw in democracy, or what is it, in the suffrage, in that people from other countries can't vote, so there's no natural constituency to garnish votes in terms of these policies.
I think that's a question that one would have to look at a country-by-country basis, even a modern country by, you know, advanced industrial country-by-country basis. I think, as I was starting to say before the break, is in the U.S., I think the stars are certainly aligning for more open borders, just having to do with problems in the U.S. I mean, one of the things that the U.S. population is becoming aware of is that the average age is getting a lot older.
Right.
It's becoming expensive to support seniors in the U.S. And if the U.S. is going to have a vibrant economy with a large group of younger workers to support older people who are taking Social Security and medical care, you're going to have to allow more people into the country. And I think that's something that's dawning on the American people. And the more conservative party on immigration has always been recent years has been the Republican Party. And the Republican Party got killed in the last election by Hispanic voters who would like to see more open borders. So I think the stars are aligning for some change in the U.S. Now, how that translates to Britain or France or Singapore, I can't tell you.
Sure.
I think a big barrier to this, though, is xenophobia. Going back to something we discussed earlier in the show, fear. It's the easiest thing in the world to make people fearful of foreigners.
Right. And right. One of the ironies, too, is that I think many opponents of freer migration are concerned that there'll be a change to the culture or downward influence. It'll have a downward influence on the culture. But the reality is that there are statistics that show that immigrants are actually less likely to commit crime. And in the case of Latin America, many of them, you would say, have more traditional values than contemporary people in the United States. So I think those arguments fall flat.
Yeah, I mean, I think those arguments really are losing currency pretty fast, at least in the States. And I think what you said about strong values of people coming from South America and Latin America, I mean, I think that there are all kinds of ironies here, and one of the ironies is that as the U.S. opens borders, it may find itself becoming more conservative culturally, which I think would be kind of a shock to the people who are advocating open borders.
That is funny, yeah. And one thing, we had a guest on from Colombia at one point after an article about the fact that actually, if you do surveys of people as to the likelihood that they will start a new business in the next year or two, the proportions are far higher in places like Colombia than here in the United States. Something like 50% of adult people plan to start a business in the next, I think, 5 years or something like that, which is not here in the U.S. And actually, immigrants start the proportion of businesses that they start in the United States is twice as great than the proportion of the population. So they're about 15% of the population and yet start about 30% of the businesses. So I just see it as such a huge win-win. And I hope that we can take away just the negative connotation that is associated with immigrants. How much traction has your article got? I mean, it was the lead article in the Freeman, which was a great placement.
Yeah, no, it was a lead article, and I've gotten a lot of favorable comments, you know, emails and from people. I have no idea how it's affecting the political process, although as I said earlier, I do think there's a lot of rethinking going on in Washington, D.C. about immigration policy. I'm sure that there are people involved with writing bills who probably come in contact with the article if only because it received such prominence when it was published, but I it's hard for me to tell exactly what kind of influence it's having.
What's the concern, though, that right now in the United States, and I'm guessing elsewhere where people consider immigration reform, that as part of the reform, people want to build a more sophisticated police state apparatus? That on next week, I'm going to be having a guest on who'll be discussing these inland borders within the United States where you have to show your citizenship actually, I think, 50 miles away from the actual border. Are you concerned about that playing into this?
I think, you know, it's hard. Again, I'd be interested to hear what your guest has to say myself. You know, part of the problem is that you've had this political battle between the two major parties, the Republicans and Democrats, over immigration for so long.
Painfully long. Yes.
Yes, and Congress is ready to do something now, but has not been willing to do something in a very long time because of all kinds of conflicts. I mean, it gets very complicated. It's not just a question of some people wanting to keep out illegal immigrants or people who cross the border illegally, but you have big businesses that rely on migrant labor to do farming so that food is available cheap. So you have what is a traditionally conservative constituency, business Republicans being in favor of migrant labor, and then you have traditionally liberal constituencies like Democrats being against it because the unions don't like the competition. So it's a very complicated subject. And I think what's happened is that there's been so much stagnation on this and so much inability of the federal government to act that the states are acting unilaterally in ways they're probably not even legally entitled to. And so you get all this publicity about some state having a restrictive law and another state has a more open law. And the states really shouldn't be doing this to begin with. The federal government should be doing it, but the federal government is not doing anything.
Right.
No. Well, they are deporting people, but in terms of actually making reforms, no. The U.S., I'll just say the U.S. Federal Congress has been stuck on this DREAM Act, going back and forth, never passing it, and just kind of arguing about it for, I'm thinking, 15 years now, a really long time. And it's just been a roadblock. Regardless, I am hopeful, but I'm not going to sit around and wait for it. On this show, I promote basically doing what's taking personal initiative and just not waiting for politics to change. But I really am glad that you wrote an article like you did, which basically shows the detrimental impacts of many of these restrictions. And I am hopeful. So, Lewis, I want to say thank you for coming on the show and for putting together a great article.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Right on. So I wanted to get on to something Rachel was discussing earlier, a related topic. So we wanted to tie in this kind of modern day slavery with what has been happening over in India.
Yeah, it's been highly publicized recently, the prevalence of rape over there. And I've been very interested for a long time in which I think is related, the issue of female infanticide over in India. A lot of people know that because of the one-child policy in China, it's very prevalent in China. But what a lot of people don't realize is it's just as big of a problem over in India. And they're actually
This preference for discriminatory abortions.
Yeah, a preference for male children. So if it's discovered that a woman is carrying a female fetus, she'll have an abortion if she has access to the equipment to find that out. Or if not, then the baby will be killed soon after birth so that she can get pregnant again with hopefully a male child. And because of that, they are missing about 50 million women.
That's insane.
In India. And I think that is so destabilizing to a culture because, I mean, think about it. That means that there's approximately 50 million men that will not be able to ever get married.
They'll have to import women from somewhere else.
There's no legitimate avenue for them to ever have sex unless they visit a prostitute.
Right.
And prostitution is it's pretty widespread in India, and I think that's got to be, you know, some sort of outlet. But those 50 million missing women means that there's a huge internal problem in India about trafficking women for you know, marriage, what they call marriage, but they're really domestic servants. And it means that the remaining women are very vulnerable, and it's a terrible problem. And there's laws against already the dowry system,
sure,
which is one reason why females are considered such a burden on the families, because the father has to basically come up with, I think, like 2 years' salary as a dowry to marry off.
To pay you for the burden of having my daughter?
Right. And women are killed over dowry disputes. And this has been illegal for a long time, but it's not been accepted.
I would be getting out of India pretty quick.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
And that's why I think it might be sort of related, the violence against women that we've been hearing about recently.
It has been coming up a lot lately.
Because we've got a lot of frustrated men over there.
Sorry. There are negative outcomes, yeah. And I have been considering that reality, the impact that disproportionate gender makeups have on the culture.
Yeah, and it's not just outright killing. In Afghanistan, I believe, they have a terrible maternal mortality rate, just because there's not a lot of healthcare, quote, wasted on women. So, you know, women over there die in alarming numbers just from childbirth. And so that's destabilizing. And that creates terrorists, frankly.
Sure. Well,
frustrated men with nothing valuable either time.
No woman domesticating them. So
yeah.
I want to say before we wrap up that if this is the first time you listen to The Stateless Man, I really appreciate you coming on to giving us your ear today, and I hope you come back. If you want to sign up for the email, it's thestatelessman.com on the right, or go to the Facebook page, The Stateless Man on Facebook. It's been a pleasure having the show again with Rachel. And
it's been a blast.
I look forward to next week. This is The Stateless Man on Overseas Radio Network.
From China's Great Wall to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, this is the Overseas Radio Network.